Okay, let me welcome everyone to today's colloquium. So today we have a very special colloquium. It will be given by Joseph Curtin, which is a distinguished violin maker that uses, among many other things, modern technology to study the sound that comes out of a violin. So Joseph was born here in very close by in Toronto, and as I said, he's a distinguished violin maker. He has received the among many other prizes, what's called the MacArthur Award, which is also called as the Genius Prize. This is especially remarkable because this is a prize that's given across all areas of human knowledge, essentially. So we are really very pleased to have him here to deliver the colloquium today. Let me say that after the colloquium, there will be, as usual, a little reception outside the bistro, and you're all welcome to attend. So without further ado, Joseph Curtin.
Thank you so much. Thank you. It's a big pleasure to be here. And I'd heard of the Perimeter Institute over the years, but arriving here yesterday, I couldn't believe how beautiful it was and how exciting it is to be in a place like this. I've been living in America for the last 35 years, and we're getting a little nervous down there. And come up here and see this sort of thing, it says, yes, this is how things should be. So thank you. So I'm curious, how many people here are violinists? Or, oh, okay. I'll have to be more careful about what I say. And how many are musicians? Okay, good. So let me introduce you a little to the my world, really. There's a lot of passionately held beliefs in the violin world, and I guess in most other fields. And I just want to go through six of them to sort of introduce the territory. And the first is that Antonio Stradivari and Giuseppe Guarneri del Gesù were the two greatest makers who ever lived. And I should say that I agree with that. No single maker since there has had the same degree of influence or originality. That said, all of their instruments now virtually are re-engineered for modern use. If you had a violin straight from Stradivari's workshop set up as he would have set it up with the strings he used and the bows they used, most of the standard repertoire would be unplayable now and arguably inaudible. But we have rather heroic version of violin history of it evolving out of nowhere in the 1500s and being brought to perfection by Stradivari and Guarneri, and then an inevitable downward drift since then. I think rather there's been a continual development which parallels the development of violin sound and with the repertoire. And it just hasn't been studied much. I'll get back to that. Oh, by the way, there is no likeness of Stradivari known. This was done, I think, in the 50s, and it's sort of Stradivari as Pinocchio's dad. Rather romantic. There's a notion of a violin maker as this lone person working in a shop carving, soul into a piece of wood, which there's some justice in that, but Stradivari's shop was certainly a busy place at the time. He had more than 100 years of help just from his sons and other great makers. Also, probably wouldn't be varnishing in his own shadow, but so violins improve with time and playing. I grew up believing that. That's widely acknowledged. I don't know anyone in the violin world who disagree with that. A lot of people even think that a violin in some way takes on the character of its greatest players, and that's some of the value given to great instruments is because they're played by Vuitton or Huberman or whoever, and then somehow they've left an imprint. We'll see. Any experienced violinist can tell a new violin from an old violin. I always thought that would be true. There's new sound and there's old sound. People talk about new sound in terms of maybe bright, maybe brash, maybe loud. Old sound is darker, rich, complex, so there should be a clearly identifiable difference. And the, a puzzling aspect of violins is projection. This relatively small instrument's got to carry in a hall and often over a large orchestra. And some instruments are better at it than others. And it's commonly believed that old great violins like Strads and Guarneri's, they may sound small under the ear, but the sound expands in the hall. And Stephen Isserles, the famous cellist, wrote in response to a paper of ours, a famous and curious feature of the Stradivarius instrument is that their tone seems to increase with distance. Of course, in physics, there's the inverse square law, which would suggest it would get smaller. But this is, again, widely believed. And new violins, on the other hand, sound loud under the ear, but they never make it past the sixth row. There's this, and I've experienced this. I as a young maker, I remember hearing my violin and then an old violin, and they indeed did seem to reverse themselves in terms of presence as I walked back a little. But we'll come up with that again. So for centuries, scientists have struggled in vain to discover the secrets of Stradivari. That came from some documentary I heard recently delivered in the golden voice of NBC or something. Really? In vain? There's been a lot of really good science done on the violin. We have a pretty good understanding of how the violin works, but there's this cultural sense that it seems important to the culture that this remains mysterious, that it's, and that's the beauty of it, and that if you lose the mystery, then we somehow lost something important from the violin world. And rather the way when Newton first explained the rainbow by, you know, as refraction of light, I think Keats wrote a poem famously a little later about how much was lost by doing that. And I know when I got into scientific research, there is this kind of tension between science and art. When I was as a young maker, I was quite against research. I thought it trampled on our art. I, of course, have changed sides since then. The truth is a lot of researchers are drawn to the violin world because of the glamour around Stradivari and the secrets of Stradivari. I think that the bad researchers keep looking for the secrets. The good researchers roll up their sleeves and do real science, which take on some particular problem and find an answer. And scientists from Savart to Helmholtz to in the 20th century Saunders and many others have all done important work, but it doesn't really make the headlines the way a piece about Stradivari's varnish being made out of shrimp shells or something like that might. And that's been done. Okay, and lastly, the best old Italian violins have playing qualities that cannot be found in instruments built elsewhere and later. And again, that's pretty much canonical. And I, as a maker, you grow up feeling like sort of a single-celled organism compared with these old things. And there's almost a feeling with women there was the glass ceiling. Like Stradivari was this level above which you cannot rise. It's what I call the spruce ceiling, and I think violin makers have been living underneath that. So what evidence is there for these various beliefs? The Jewish theologian Abraham Heschel was once asked, do the Jews have a logical proof for the existence of God? And he said, no, we rely on eyewitness accounts. And I think it's the same in the violin world. We learn from our teachers who've heard so-and-so play it. You know, these things are passed on, and it's a very compelling tradition, and one that's quite difficult to get on the outside of. So how do you find evidence for these seemingly subjective impressions of instruments? Well, the first answer is, of course, to do blind tests. Now, the first blind tests, interestingly, were done, the first known one was done back in France in 1784. The King of France, King Louis, his wife, Marie Antoinette, was been treated by Mesmer, now known for mesmerism. He was sort of what we'd call a holistic healer. And the king wanted to find out whether this guy was for real. So he established a scientific committee headed by Benjamin Franklin, who got Lavoisier, another famous scientist. And their stroke of genius wasn't to test whether the treatment actually worked, but to see whether the practitioners could identify vital fluids, which they had instilled in various things. Mesmer had discovered animal magnetism. That was a mechanism of healing and things. So they had his practitioners charge up, you know, things with vital fluids, and then they're blindfolded and it picked the ones, and they couldn't. And Mesmer was driven out of town, which is probably sad because he, by all evidence, he was a good-hearted practitioner. But they also concluded from the study that the effects, the beneficial effects on Marie Antoinette were probably from her belief in the efficacy of this cure. And it's probably the first mention of the placebo effect, which of course now been very well studied. There's also another effect called the nocebo effect, when people experience the bad side effects of drugs they're not actually taking. And I think that's more applies to new violins than the placebo effect. Placebo comes from the Latin, I shall please, and nocebo from I shall displease. So blind tests have been done with violins for a long time. They're usually informal. None of them were done with the kind of rigor that would pass as scientific evidence today. So although a lot of this work could have been done much earlier for probably cultural reasons, it wasn't. There was a BBC ran a blind test on the radio, and just because there's a recording of it, it's interesting to play a bit of it. They got Pinchas Zukerman, Isaac Stern, two of the greatest violinists of the century, and Charles Beer, who's one of the probably the foremost violin expert of the 20th century. They were the jury, and another violinist who was a concertmaster at the London Symphony at the time, I believe, played a Stradivaria Guarneri of Vuillaume, which is was a very well-regarded French maker from the 1800s, excuse me, and a new instrument by a fellow called Ronald Prale. And so the violinist behind by the screen, these experts were asked to say which was which. So let me just play, I've edited it down to some brief excerpts. The recording's not good, but still you can hear differences. And so just listen, maybe guess which one you think is a Strad or a Guarneri or a new violin or a French violin. Guesses? It's not obvious, and the best any of the experts did was 2 out of 4. So these are the answers. The first was a French violin, the next was a Guarneri, then the new violin, then the Stradivari. Now, these are the waveforms of those recordings I just put there, and what we can everyone agree they sounded different, the different violins. I mean, some louder, some softer. So I think we agree they're different sounding violins. It's not obvious that we recognize the voice as a Guarneri voice, a Strad voice, but also they sound different, and looking at the waveforms, they look different, which suggests there is some sort of objective relationship between the actual sound radiated and the instrument doing the radiating. So these are two people I've worked with closely. Fan Chiatao is a string researcher at Dario Strings, the biggest string manufacturer in the world. And we run an acoustics workshop together for violin makers. And Claudia Fritz, I met in Cambridge University. She was a postdoctoral, a postdoc. She was studying how people evaluate instruments. I was very interested in, well, that, but also how do you measure the sound output of instruments. So a chance came up a couple of years later to run a blind test at the Indianapolis International Violin Competition. It was sort of a last minute thrown together, no funding, but we managed to wrangle a Strad and a Guarneri and some new instruments. We did it in a hotel room. There's two Strads, one Guarneri, and three new violins. And we had quite a large hotel room, and we put a screen up in it. And we had maybe 26 players, competition, entrance, orchestras, some soloists from the jury. And they were asked to choose their favorites in one-minute pairwise comparisons. This was from playing them. And then they were given 20 minutes to play all the violins and pick out the one they'd most like to take home with them, and also to pick out their least favorite violin. And then they were asked to guess which was new and which was old. And the results, well, briefly, were that the favorite violin was new, the least favorite was a Strad, and the player seemed unable to tell new from old. Now, this, for me, was the most striking thing. It doesn't matter so much that this particular Strad didn't sound good at this time, or this particular new violin sounded great at that time. But having grown up with this notion of old sound and new sound, and old sound being what I want to get and new sound being what I inevitably produce, to see really top-notch violinists playing a Strad and making a sour face and putting it down, then picking up a new violin that had been finished 2 weeks ago and think this is an excellent old Italian violin, it changed something in me. It kind of shattered a faith I had in the violin world as I knew it anyway. But we had a fair bit of criticism. The first was that it was done in a hotel room. Earl Carlos said, like testing a Ferrari in a parking lot. Fair enough. But then again, I don't know of any good player who hasn't played in hotel rooms, and many of them, so it's not impossible to learn something about a violin in a hotel room. We had too few violins, true. It'd be better if we had 10 Strads and 10 Guarneris and 10 new instruments, but we didn't. More seriously, that we had picked the best new violins and the worst Strads, or we'd somehow misadjusted them. And really just saying, you know, we put our thumbs on the scale. And I remember I mentioning this message had come into that effect, and Claudia Fritz laughed and said, if we wanted to cheat, we'd just change the numbers. There's no need to to touch the violins, which is very, very true. The final, more perplexing criticism, it takes a long time to learn to play a Strad. And you have players saying this. It took me 2 years to learn to play my Strad. But then it took me places I'd never been before. Whereas presumably new instruments, and people have said this outright, they give everything right away or they don't. Maybe. These are all things to be tested. But that's a difficult one to test. Blind testing, we generally rely on fairly short experiences. And we justify it in one way by saying that whenever a maker chooses violins, at some point they have to see a number of violins and they have to make some quick decisions. And first impressions are important. And so it's at least worth starting with the simple things one can do and getting a sense of the territory. And the Indianapolis experiment was very suggestive. Hugh Borsarello is a French violin soloist who loves old Italian violins, and he completely disagreed with our results, and he called Claudia Fritz and you know said you're doing it all wrong. But unlike other critics, he said, well, why don't I help you design a better experiment? I can work with dealers and get instruments. So we did. A year later, we had 10 soloists arrived in Paris, and we had something like, I think, 9 Strads and Guarneris to choose from, and a bunch of other old Italians. We had instruments from about 17 new makers. We had a beautiful concert hall about this size with excellent acoustics. So each violinist had to choose the violin that they think would best replace their own for an upcoming concert tour. We thought that was a reasonable question to ask. And they had two 75-minute sessions in which to do that. Now, except for not being able to see it, they were wearing these goggles. They could play whatever they liked on it. They could play with in a small room. They could play it in a hall. They could play with a piano. They could play without. They could even have a trusted listener out in the audience telling them which they thought suited them better. So we thought this was a reasonably good way of getting to at least a strong indication of what violin would suit them, at least for an upcoming tour. We also asked them to eliminate unsuitable violins. We found from watching people in other tests that players tend to pick up some violins and just really, they don't work, they'll put them down. Maybe if they played them for 2 years, they would change their mind. But we find that a good way to narrow the field because they can spend a lot of time with their most preferred violins. And so having them eliminate violins first was helpful. Which did the soloist prefer? We just did a point system where it was the first choice of one soloist, it was given 4 points, second choice, 3 points, and so on. And N in front of a name means new violin and O means old violin. There was 6 new violins, there were 5 Strads, and there was 1 other old Italian. And all the Strads were golden period or later. So they weren't some early instruments of his with unusual arching or anything. These were nominally top-notch Strads. The least preferred, again, was a Strad. It was rejected by the most people, but also a new violin was right down there with it. The most preferred easily was a new. The one that was chosen, 4 soloists chose the most preferred new violin. 3 chose the most preferred Strad. So those 2 instruments kind of dominated, and then it went down from there. Now, when it came to saying which was new or old, this might not be obvious, but the right answers are the black lines, the wrong are the gray ones, and the darker gray are indeterminate. When they couldn't tell, like they said, this is 19th century French or something, we just consider that indeterminate. And essentially, the distribution of guesses and the fact that there were about equal number of right and wrong answers about each violin, our statistician said it's essentially chance. Or they did know better than chance. Now, we wanted to see whether the audience could tell whether they're playing old or new. And so we played a little bit of a trick in that we pretended that they were playing their test violins, but we wanted them to be playing their own violins because people could argue that it takes time to get to know an instrument, and playing an instrument you've only played for an hour might not be fair. So basically, 7 soloists came out playing their own instruments, which 4 of them were old Italians, 3 of them were new. And the audience, they played for a full minute a concerto excerpt on it, and then the audience was asked whether it was new or old. Again, the results were basically random. The first one, 85% thought it was new, it was old. The next one, about the same percentage thought it was old, and it was or new, whatever the opposite of that is. And then they're pretty much evenly divided. There's a distribution of the correct guesses. So it does seem that the it's not easy for players or listeners to identify instruments. At the same time, they seem to have very little trouble picking the ones they liked or didn't like. They could make all sorts of comments about particular qualities. So it wasn't as though they couldn't hear anything, and they all agreed that the test conditions were adequate for the task. But the question really becomes, why are violins so hard to tell apart? The question before was, why is Strad so obviously better? I can This is really speculation, but I think it's probably not far from the truth. The violin is often described as an instrument closest to the human voice. Of course, I've heard cellists say the same thing. I've heard clarinetists say the same thing. I've heard saxophone players say the same thing. We want to believe we're expressing ourselves in this way. But we're really good at telling other humans apart. Imagine these three famous people saying "God bless America" behind a screen. I don't think anyone who's heard their voice would have any trouble separating which is which. Why? Presumably we evolved to distinguish things about each other's voices. As social animals, that was a useful thing to do. But more technically, most musical instruments consist of an oscillator and a resonator. So with the violins, the strings, the bowed string is the oscillator, the instrument body is the resonator. With woodwinds, it can be the reeds. With trumpets, it's the mouthpiece, and so on. If you look at the voice, the larynx is the resonator, and it's highly mobile and affected by many, many things. And with the violin, the bowed string is the oscillator, and it's highly nonlinear, wildly nonlinear, which makes a big difference. I think I'll run out of time if I get into details with that. Let's just say that with the resonator for the human voice is the vocal tract, and of course that too is highly malleable, and we shape our voices by changing the shape of our vocal tract, and that's how we make vowels and consonances and everything. With the violin, on the other hand, it's this box. It's very fixed in its resonances, and it's rather like a room is fixed in its resonance. You can move chairs around or put in a curtain to change it. With a violin, you could adjust it one way or the other and put a new post or a heavier bridge. But once the violinist picks it up, the acoustics of the instruments are pretty much fixed. Now, the ear pretty much ignores things that stay the same. I mean, our perceptions generally evolve to detect changes. So again, I'm speculating that we have this fixed set of resonances, and then we have this wildly interesting thing happening with the violin that the player is doing, and that's what our ears are riveted to, and that's what we think about. So we recognize the playing gestures of the violinist much more than the resonance of the instrument. Now, not all rooms make good concert halls, and not all violins make good tools for violinists to do this with. So the next question is, what makes a good violin and what makes a less good violin? I will get back to that question. We also tested violin projection there, and I'd like to play. When you're testing violinists, they can organize their own thoughts. They can pick up and play and pick up another instrument and go back. When you've got 50 listeners and you're trying to compare a bunch of violins, it's a very different problem. We know that people can compare sounds most efficiently if they're short and they're closely spaced, like within a few seconds. We have much better memory for tone color and other things. So what you want is quick comparisons between two excerpts. Now, to do that with every combination of, let's say, six old and six new is a punishingly long experiment. So we restricted ourselves to three old, three new. What we had was first playing without orchestra. Violin A, then violin B, then violin A again, then violin B again. That would be one unit. We did the same thing later with orchestra. We were interested in, is projection the same without orchestra and with orchestra? There's a notion that a great violin does something that keeps it above the orchestra, whereas in a solo violin, there's no competition. Is it the same thing? So again, you can be the judges. Here is a solo excerpt played by one of the soloists in Paris, recorded with the stereo mics about nine feet away in a more or less typical recording position. So we'll hear violin A, violin B, violin A, violin B. Tell me which you think. Have a show of hands after which you think projects better, whatever that means to you. You can hear better. Thank you. Who thought violin A projected better? Violin B? Okay, so violin B is a pretty clear winner on that one. And violin B was the most preferred new violin. Violin A was the most preferred Strad. And we found actually that doing the same test via recordings from these microphones gave the same results as listeners in the hall, which was a huge relief for us. It means you can actually don't have to assemble an orchestra. And we found it was the same without orchestra. But, so let me just give you the sample with orchestra, rather a beautiful passage from the Sibelius Concerto. A projected better? Violin B. Okay, again, and again it was the Strad and the was violin A and the new one was violin B. Now the question arose, these were the results. This paper hasn't been published yet, it'll appear next month. Each of the old violins compared with each of the new violins, and one of the Strads was about equal to one of the new ones, or two of the Strads were more or less equal. The others were pretty much roundly out-projected by the new violins. A question arose. There isn't really a scientific definition of projection yet. We're working on that. Does it mean if you say a violin projects better that you prefer it? Or are there violins that, okay, they're louder, but I really don't like the quality? And that's an important question because that's the sort of thing that people would say about new violins. They are loud, but they lack fill in the blank. So what we did, we mounted another full-scale study in New York, about 50 listeners and three new violins and three Strads and the same format. We didn't use orchestra this time because we had already found out that wasn't necessary. But we asked half the audience to judge preference, the other to judge projection, and then we rotated in different segments. And what we found were, so the lines to that side means new violins project better, and that means new violins are preferred. The different colors are, there's two different players, and projection and preference depend partly on the player. There's definitely an element. But we can see they pretty much rhyme with each other. Generally speaking, a violin that projects better is preferred. What I think we're going to be able to show next is that if you asked which violin is louder, it would do just as well. In fact, we did a little experiment last year where loudness judged by players 5 feet away corresponded very closely with projection judged by the audience. So unfortunately, loudness has negative connotations in our culture. To be told that your violin or your jacket or your tie or your friend is loud is not usually a compliment. But it does seem, if we can get past that, it does seem to, yes, loud violin, that should be a compliment. If you want to be heard, over an orchestra or in a hall. If you're blending in with an orchestra, it's a different question. And not all players are soloists, clearly. The vast majority need to fit in with an ensemble, whether it's a string quartet or an orchestra. And then you don't necessarily want the violin with the best projection. I hypothesize that that's something else we need to study. So we can't say which violin is good or will be preferred just by looking at the label. That's evident. We can't by just saying it's old or new. And yet, there are strong differences in preference among instruments. So what's going on? And a sort of the holy grail of violin research has been trying to figure out objective measurements that correspond and could predict preference. Of course, violin makers have been doing it in their own way with the varnish. If it's got the right varnish, it'll sound great. You know, but this is these are sort of static measurements of possibly or probably irrelevant factors. What we want to do is take dynamic measurements, measure the acoustics of the instruments, and see if we can see some correlations between what players prefer and what the instrument does when measured objectively. How do you measure a violin? There's a famous story of Heifetz being approached after his concert, and someone said, "Mr. Heifetz, your violin sounds wonderful." And he apparently, "Really? I don't hear anything." Well, if you treat the violin as a resonator, essentially, you ignore the bow. You can try and measure the acoustics of the violin, and try and make some correlations. One of the measurements most associated with sound quality in general is the spectrum of the sound. That's how much energy there is at different frequencies. It's when you adjust the balance on your hi-fi between treble and bass, you're affecting the weight of the spectrum. When recording engineers move their little knobs up and down, that's what they're working with. Spectrum was first used by Newton in talking about light, and you can look at the spectrum of light via a rainbow or spectrometers, and the spectrum defines the color and a lot of other subjective things. Is the same thing true for violin sound? We also know that it would be naive just to look at the spectrum, but it's a good place to start. So how do you measure the violin spectrum? Unlike light, where you can use a prism, there wasn't really very much you could do for a long time. In the 1800s, Helmholtz, the famous scientist, he was studying sound, and he invented these little resonators called Helmholtz resonators, and they would resonate at a very sharp frequency, and he would put them up to his ear and listen, and if the frequency that corresponded to that was present, he would hear that very loudly, so you could systematically break the sounds down into their component frequencies. Now, the first ever audio spectrum analyzer, as far as I can tell, was made by a guy called Rudolf Koenig. And funny enough, he was a violin maker who had apprenticed to Vuillaume. And he read Helmholtz's work on the sensation of tone and was super interested. He was really good with metal, and he started building these beautiful brass resonators. And he later put together this machine where there's 10 resonators attached to what's called a flame nanometer, where you have the flames will start flickering or doing something when the tube from the resonator hits a resonance. So it's like you could tell 10 frequencies if they're present in a sound at a certain time. Of course, nowadays, thanks to the computer, we can do it much more quickly. And thanks to Fourier, a scientist who developed what's called the Fourier transform, where you can go from the time domain to the frequency domain and do it very quickly. Interesting stories about him, but I'll leave them aside. So what I've been doing is measuring violins using a tool that's become available in the last few decades, really, which is a miniature impulse hammer. It's a tiny little hammer with a force sensor. So if you tap something with it, it'll have a record of the exact history of the impact. And if you tap a violin bridge, you will excite the violin the way the bowed string does it. The bowed string applies the force to the bridge. So what my aim was is to excite all the resonances of a violin that a player can by playing it. So to do that, we need to tap it in at least two directions because different bowing angles, there's a combination of horizontal and vertical. So I tap horizontally and vertically. And also violins, they radiate sound evenly all around at low frequencies, but they get very directional at high frequencies. So you need to do a number of measurements, and different researchers have used, one research used 288 microphones in an anechoic chamber, trying to get a detailed picture of how the violin radiates. That's not very practical. A thing about this kind of research is you have to take the equipment to the violins. You can't bring a lot of these strads and players into laboratories. So I developed this as a portable tool. And what it does is measures 12 points around the violin from hitting the bridge and at two different angles, vertically and horizontally. And this was the software written actually by a friend of mine, a violin maker who taught himself coding and is doing really making major contributions to violin research now through modal analysis. That's George Stepani. Now, can you see the cursor as it moves? So that is the signal from the hammer, which is very short, less than a thousandth of a second. Now, the physics is that if you hit a very short pulse, has the same amount of energy at all frequencies, which is very useful for trying to see how something radiates at all frequencies. So it's a single pulse, but it excites a wide range of frequencies more or less evenly. If it was infinitely short, it'd be absolutely a straight line. Because it isn't, it has a spectrum of its own, and this little red line up here shows the variations. So what we do is we take the microphone signal here, which lasts maybe two-tenths of a second at the most with the strings damped, and divide it by the hammer signal, and that'll give us what's called the impulse response, which is the amount of sound radiated at all frequencies by if excited by a perfect impulse. To reduce the noise, you can do a number of taps at each violin at each microphone position. So I end up doing 5 taps at each position and 24 total measurements. Okay, this is the this is 5 microphone positions of a 1734 Stradivari, and the lower half is dominated by a number of low frequency resonances, and these radiate evenly, isotropically. At higher frequencies, you get more and more and more resonances. They're so dense that you can't really divide them. You really need to talk about them statistically. But still, violins, because of their common structure, show common spectral features, even at high frequencies. And I'll get back to the spectrum. Let me take a single measurement, a single impulse response. It sounds like this. We still have sound. So the miraculous thing is that is an actual sound that Stradivari can make as heard from one microphone position. And you can translate that into what's called a frequency domain, which is looking at the spectrum plus phase, which isn't shown. And it can go back and forth between those two, thanks to Fourier. Now, my physicist collaborator, Gabriel Weinreich, introduced me to convolution, which is what's used for artificial reverberation. You take an impulse response of a hall, and you convolve the sound of anything with it, and you'll get that sound as though in that hall. So what we did was I built an electric violin that has no resonances, or as few as possible, so it's pretty much getting the purest string signal. And I had a very good violinist play, you guessed it. So that kind of buzzy, uninteresting sound is characteristic of electric violin. It's pretty much the sound the string's making. Then this is the impulse response of the cathedral strad. Now you put those two together and you get... So very much like a good violin. The old chestnut is that a great violinist can make even a cigar box sound good, so I decided to measure a cigar box. I put it in my rig and tapped it. My wife's grandfather loved cigars, so we happened to have these sort of memorial cigar boxes around. And here is that same Tchaikovsky excerpt played through the cigar box. Sounds like a violin. And then a well-known Guarneri del Gesù. So again, the graphs are the spectrum of the two. The blue is the Guarneri, the black is the violin. And again, there's obvious oral differences and obvious measurement differences. What time are we at? I think I'm going to have to move very quickly. There have been various historical studies done in the last 50 years about what spectral shapes are preferred by listeners and players. They unfortunately weren't done using blind testing, so they were done, this is an old violin, so it's good, and this is a factory violin, so it's bad, and so on. Some people thought evenness across the spectrum is good. Everyone agreed that the very lowest resonance was important. But what about how much power is rated? That was ignored, perhaps because it was thought crude to think about loudness. I don't know. These are the spectrum for all the six strads, the six old violins and the six new in Paris. They are overlaid. And you can see there's common features again, some dominant low frequency resonance and then kind of a haystack of features. And I'm just going to average them all. We can say that's the average spectrum of the test violins. And then I'm going to smooth it so it's a little easier to follow what happens. Now, these are all the test violins and the soloist's own violins. And we see they're rather similar. I mean, the lines differ a bit. So this is 12 of the soloist's personal violins compared with the 12 test violins. But we are pleased to see they seem to be in the same ballpark. This is all the new test violins and all the old ones. And now we start to see some more systematic differences, which suggests there are some differences between new and old. And I think there are, but not for the reasons that they're old, but for structural reasons. But that's I can't get into that now. Now here are the six most preferred and the six least preferred. And suddenly we see a much clearer difference. One seems to put out more sound than the other. The three most preferred, three least preferred, again, becomes more striking. The two most preferred, the two least preferred, even more striking. The single most preferred and the single least preferred. So one of the common sense takeaways from this is that amount of sound is important, certainly to soloists. None of this work on parameters is published yet, so this is all in its preliminary phases. And all of these findings, we're doing more experiments to try and verify or disqualify them. Especially this, I'm going to skip these. Okay, so this is a graph of the sensitivity of the human ear. Some of you may be familiar. The lower the line, the less sound it takes for us to hear it, the limits of audibility. Our ear has a typical ear canal is about yay long, and it has a resonance around just under 4 kilohertz, which means that explains why around 3.8 kilohertz is the nominal most sensitive point of the ear, because that's where the air in the ear canal is resonating. Now let's look at the all test violins, just keeping that frequency in mind. The six most preferred, the six least preferred, three most preferred, three least, two most, two least. Now, I don't know how robust this is, whether it'll be verified, nothing, but I'm just fascinated by the idea that good violins talk to that sensitivity of the ear in that way. And it would certainly help explain projection, for example, if the better projecting violins, and indeed the best, most preferred violin was by far the best projecting, had by far the most energy in that area. So that's a promising area for more testing. Obvious comment, Even the most preferred violin was rejected out of hand by at least two players. And in the middle, there's a lot of violin, you know, these are really good violinists, and some of them love violins that half the people didn't like, which suggests, did I say this before, that there isn't really a unique, I did say it before, a unique definition of quality. But I think the thrust of research has been to separate a good violin from a bad violin. I think it becomes pretty obvious that there's clusters of qualities, how bright it is, how dark it is, how loud it is under the air, how quiet, how warm it is, whatever that means. And so now we're sort of dividing up into finding parameters for individual qualities. We think we have one for brightness that's pretty robust. I'm gonna skip. Oh yeah, there was one interesting thing. The number of soloists who chose violin as the one to replace her on their tour, 4 chose N5, 3 chose O1, 1 chose N10, and 1 and 1. And if you look at the level of the low frequencies, 200 to 800, compared with high, really it seems that having a good amount of low frequencies is important to players. And that, again, that's only suggestive. I can't say that's true for every player or generally true, but I have a strong hunch that will play out. The first time I ever went to an acoustics convention, I really understood almost nothing that anyone said, but the man who became my mentor and friend, Gabby Weinreich, said, if we knew what it is a good violin does and then designed an instrument that did only that, I'd be surprised if it looked like a traditional violin. And I was kind of shocked and annoyed by that. You know, what did these scientists know about? You know, there's a reason for everything we do, and it has to be done that way. Well, I've since completely changed my mind. Here is a picture of two steering wheels, both from race cars. One's from a 1954 Mercedes, a rather beautiful object. The other's from a Formula One race car. And it might as well be an attack helicopter or a video game controller. They're so different. You wouldn't enter those two cars into a race together. There's a Bugatti Type 35 from the 1920s. It was arguably the most successful race car ever in that it won a lot of races. And there's a very successful Ferrari F2004. Now, it's interesting. That car looks old-fashioned, and it's not just a matter of styling. I think it reflects, I think when we say something is old-fashioned in the functional sense, it's because it doesn't reflect our current understanding of how things work. No one would build a race car with the center of gravity that high. No one would forget about streamlining. There's just so much we know about how things work, and that changes the design profoundly. And again, no one would enter a classic car into a Formula One race because they wouldn't get off the starting block. Here are two tennis rackets. One, Arthur Ashe won a competition in 1968 with it, and the other was Serena Williams in 2014. And again, apart from the strings being in better condition, they are very different. You couldn't win a tournament on a wooden tennis racket any more than you could win a sailboat race in a wooden sailboat. So I think Weinreich was absolutely right. The more we know about how things work and why they work, if we're talking about functional objects rather than the works of art, the better it is for development. Here is two violins, one built in 1704 and one built in 2011. And you can see how much progress has been made. A lot of our self-esteem comes in how well we can copy the earlier ones. And that's beginning to change, I think. It is an exciting time to be a violin maker, and what I'm most interested in seeing is, once we understand better the science, can the violin begin to evolve again? And that's all I have to say. Thank you. Do we have time for questions? Okay.
Questions? Raise your hand. Oof. Yeah, good workout.
I'm just wondering about the variabilities of bows and strings, how that enters into these contests or the blind tests and so on at all.
We chose with bows to have each violinist play their own bow, considered an extension of their bow hand. The other possibility was to have everyone use the same bow, but then people would just be variously uncomfortable. So it's a variable. The hope was that if you have enough instruments, that'll factor itself out. But the bow is hugely important. I think you can more easily tell the difference between bows in blind tests than violins. So I agree it's important, but one has to take things one step at a time. Strings, too, it's been less studied, their effects on listeners. We haven't done blind tests yet.
Can the violinists recognize their own violins being played by other people, ones that they've been familiar with for many, many years, like we would be with a voice of a person having heard it many years?
That's a good question. We haven't tried that yet, partly because violinists don't necessarily want their violin played by other people, and a lot of blind testing has to do with respecting, you know, the feelings of what the owners of the instruments, the players, and when your own instrument's at stake, it the ethics of it becomes a little tricky. So we don't know. We did do, as one way of testing this, in the Paris experiment, we asked players to play their own instrument and then their favorite of the test instruments, a 1 minute or 30 second piece on each. And then we asked the audience which suits them better. And a lot of cases it was, you know, their new test instruments, or not new or old. It wasn't obvious that the audience could tell they were playing their own instrument, which was a bit surprising. We thought that it'd immediately be more comfortable, but.
No, but you were asking whether people could distinguish one old violin from another one, but these are violins they've never heard before, perhaps. So it would be unlike human voices for that reason. We wouldn't have heard them many times.
Yeah,
so
well.
If a person's really familiar with the sound of the instrument, could they then recognize it? It might be something to look at.
Well, here's a thought experiment. Imagine the voice of, I don't know, Tom Waits or Maria Callas or anyone. Depending on your mind, you can call something to mind, or the voice of your boyfriend or wife or whatever, you can call it to mind. Now imagine the sound of a Stradivari. What do you hear? Violin playing? Maybe you can remember this part of Perlman's recording on the Strad. I don't think there's anything that the recognition part of our mind can get around. I mean, bats can recognize their kids in a cave among millions of others just by the sound. I mean, that's recognition. I don't think anything the violin does, I don't think we have the neural structures to process that enough.
And yet, when people select an instrument in a store, even people, parents who come in saying into the store, they say, I know nothing about violins. Immediately they can start telling the differences when their kids play the violins and they say, oh, I like that one better.
Oh.
You know, they can tell what they like the sound of better, and so can the kids, even though they may not have had any practice. And
preference,
the ones that
absolutely.
We pick are generally also the ones that they pick, which is really interesting.
Preference, absolutely. It's just saying new or old or other things to do with identifying, it seems very difficult for people. And we've done not just these two, but many other experiments. And it's a very, very slippery thing. Now, players would seem to have a better chance. And it's a multimodal thing, playing an instrument. And they've got the feel of the instrument, the playability. I think, Jeremy, you could recognize your own violin if you picked it up blind, do you think? Mm-hmm. Yeah, 20 is a lot. Well, a big factor, too, is just listener exhaustion. Can you believe it? We did this couple of ABAs. The audience did it for 3 hours, and it's really a challenge to do it enough to get reasonably good data. Other questions?
Yeah, one question I had was the preference that people have for loud passages is pretty well known, at least in audiophile circles, right, as you know.
Yes.
So have you done anything to take that out of the picture, just to record all these violins, high-quality recording, and normalize the volume and then play them back to people?
That's exactly what I would love to do next. The trouble is, one question is, how do you normalize the volume, I think the way to do it would be to have first have the listener adjust these violins till they sound as loud and then start comparing. And that would be a very fruitful thing to do, especially now that we know that people do make the same judgments from recordings as in life. So I would love to pursue that further. I think a lot of this could be done on online experiments now, and we could learn a lot.
Yeah, actually, I have a couple of questions. First, on preference, you said people do have clear preferences. Did you test the stability of that, like ask them the next day which fiddle they prefer, and see if it was the same one?
Yes. The Paris players, we let them know what they'd chosen the day before so they could build on that. And some of them changed their mind, but mostly it was consistent. But Claudia Fritz did in Montreal a test specifically on that, where they did the same test for a week with players, and they found they were really quite consistent.
The other question was about the linearity or non-linearity. I mean, you seem to think that everything was linear, but I mean, if you hear like a wolf note on a, especially on a cello or something like that, that's presumably not a linear phenomenon. So I don't know how significant that is, except when to avoid the wolf note, but...
Well, no, the wolf note is a bowed string phenomenon. The bowed string is very nonlinear. I mean, it's interacting with a linear resonance. I mean, when we say a violin is behaving linear, it's within the normal range. If you drop it on the floor, it'll do some nonlinear things. But the vibration of the body seems to be linear, and a wolf note doesn't change that.
When you're playing, you have the string and everything is
involved. Well, that's because you're playing with a bow.
Yeah, right.
And the bow isn't linear at all.
So just looking at that linear response spectrum is not maybe the whole story about the violin then.
Absolutely not. It's making, it was an interesting, well, someone did a study with bows, with a bowing machine that put real bows on real violins and could play exactly the same pressure and velocity and position with different bows on the same violin. What we found was exactly the same sound came out no matter what the bow. And yet if you gave it to a player, it sounded completely different. So it's not as though the vibrations of the bow are talking to the violin, but the bow allows players or forces them to do very different things when they're playing, and that's again on the nonlinear side. And the bowed string is a really difficult field, and there's good work been done in it. But the wolf note is quite well understood, but there's plenty that isn't.
Really interesting experiment, and wow, so many variables. I don't know how you can take everything into consideration. I'm wondering too about the bow in all of this, and I'm not a violinist, but I wonder, when violinists choose a bow, they're choosing to how it makes the instrument respond, mm-hmm. and how it feels when they play. So if I'm a violinist and if I'm playing a new violin, then my bow is going to be more responsive, more matched with that new violin. So then if I go to play an older violin, I'm not going to get as nice a sound. So how does that affect your experiment? So that was my first question. And my other question is, you know, depending on the audience, I mean, I guess you've got a big enough sample size when you've got a big audience, but, you know, if you have an audience of musicians, professional musicians, are you going to get different results than if you've just got general public? You know, people with trained ears versus, you know, people with quote-unquote untrained ears.
Well, to answer the second question first, the level of expertise didn't seem to make much difference. We analyzed by violin makers, by players, by... And in the New York experiment, it was just whoever showed up. It was during a violin-making meeting, but there was no guarantee. The Paris, they were invited because they were audiophiles or players or conductors. But there didn't seem to be, you know, years of experience. It didn't seem to be strong. And I mean, just playing those examples I played today with you know, many different groups, it's not that subtle a difference. Now, your first question was a little more complicated. You're saying that you're assuming that a new violin would need a new bow to bring out the best qualities? Why do you think it's not a match? You think there's some difference in the physical behavior of the... Well, it's a good question, but I would vote that we leave out old and new and simply ask, do particular bows match particular instruments better? And we actually want to do this experiment this summer. Imagine you put down 10 violins, or no, 6 violins and 6 bows, and have a bunch of players match the bows to the instrument. Would they all choose the same bows, or would it be completely random? And that's a really interesting question. Is the bow for the player and helping them mediate an instrument, or are we going to see a clustering of this bow tends to work better with that instrument, and this with that? The old-new question is problematic for the reasons I've given. We can't assert there's an objective difference now. Well, we picked for the Paris experiment, I think, 4 of the players played new violins full-time and 6 of them played old full-time. And actually, 1 of them played both. So we tried to be fair that way. There doesn't seem to be, we can find really nothing separating old and new in any obvious way, except to say that if the audience had simply decided that the violins they preferred listening to were new, they would have got it right most of the time. So in a sense, we're listening for our expectations. It could be that there are some general differences between new and old. There are. Old instruments are generally thinner, for example. Their resonant modes tend to be a little lower in frequency. But unless you're listening for that particularly, you're not going to notice it, because there's plenty of new violins that have little thinner tops and a little darker in sound. So it's a problem. I think what we're heading towards is something like, what they're doing all the time with, online preferences. If you like this book and this book, you'll probably like this book. If you like this violin, my guess is you'll like this. I think we will find that to be the case. I think people do have preferences, and they will manifest themselves in specific ways, and hopefully we'll be able to measure those specific things and make a more informed guess as a maker. If I'm making a violin for you, what you're going to like. Right now it's intuition and experience and guesswork.
I have a question about the last part of your talk, essentially the question which is there. And if I go back to the picture you were showing about the cars,
yes,
not only they're different in their designs, as you mentioned, that we understood aerodynamics, but one is in metal and the other is in carbon fiber. So they're completely different in their structure too. As far as I can tell, all the pictures of the violin you have shown are in wood.
Yes.
And so it begs the question, what is the rationale? Why not use carbon fiber resins? I mean, how much as a violin maker have people tried to really, go beyond the tradition? I mean, I know it's a tradition that it has to be in wood, but if you're asking the question, is there a rationale for that? And how much people have really tried to design new instrument based on new materials?
Well, graphite bows are now all over the place. And the violin is more difficult. I spent some years working with graphite composites with a French scientist, Charles Besnainu. And it's very promising, but it's when you're using laminates, which you need to do, the idea is to reduce the stiffness to weight ratios, the same as increase the stiffness to weight ratios as in race cars or a lot of other high performance things. You can put a very strong material like graphite and separate it by something very light, and you can get these enormously stiff and light things. But once you make it, you can't change it. And so to develop something like that would require a huge I mean, probably be computer modeling of what's going to happen, and then, you know, multiple iterations. And there isn't anyone who's done that yet for lack of funding. Otherwise, it doesn't lend itself very well to small production. Graphite fiber by nature is, the damping is very low. We want a higher damping for a violin anyway, not for a bow. Things that ring longer tend to take longer to get them started. We want guitars to ring longer because you pluck them and they ring. With a violin, you're continually putting energy in. You want it to go right away. This instrument is made with balsa, which is much lighter than wood, and with a spruce veneer on the outside. And I tested this quite a bit, and I can make what I think is the loudest violin in the world, immeasurably. And I've snuck them into blind tests. It's difficult with new materials to start shaping the spectral balance, but I think it's very exciting. And the direction I think one does want to go is in reducing the weight. Funnily enough, of the million things violin makers have been concerned about, old instruments, you know, the varnish, the purfling, the details of the measurements, no one was really measuring the weight. And when a researcher called Carleen Hutchins suggested I start measuring the weight of my tops, and I remember doing it, it might be 75 or 80 grams. First time I had a Strat open in the shop, I weighed the top, it was 54 grams without the bass bar. I thought, that's not subtle, that's like, you know, 30% lighter. And that was maybe 20 years ago, and really the thrust of my personal research and development has been, how do you increase performance by going even further than the old Italians? And then you get into what I call ultralights. And I think, I hope that it will be controlled, and we will be able to do things that you couldn't do with old violins. And I certainly know that you can out-project them. How much sound can you tolerate under your ears? Again, it becomes rather like a race car. Driving in a sports car might be fun, but these race car drivers is unbelievable. They're sitting in a furnace with piles of clothing with enormous G-forces. I mean, you have to be an incredibly fit athlete just to take one of these around the track. Do violinists want to play that? Well, maybe if the audience response is so overwhelming, but we're in a very different field. And I think if they would make violin playing an Olympic sport, for example, and you'd get sponsors, you know, the Nike violin team, and, you know, people are putting real, then things would change. And oddly enough, the arts were part of the Olympics, right? Both in Greece and when they came back in the late 1800s. But in fact, there's a Canadian composer, John Weinzweig, he had a gold medal from the Olympics in music. Who knew that? So I vote we get the performing arts back in the competitions. Yes.
So I'm wondering how much custom work instrument makers are doing now. So do you have instrumentalists who will come in and say, I want a string quartet violin, I want it with these characteristics, I want it to blend with these other instruments? I mean, are you at the stage where you can do that type of work rather than just make the best violin possible?
Yes and no. I think the more experience you have as a maker, the better you can do it. When you start off, maybe your first violin sounds great, and then the next one is terrible, the next one's better. You don't really know what to do. Over the years, you get more and more strategies of how to control things while you're making them. And for me, with measurements, it's added a much more solid way of controlling. But I think we try and intuit what the players want as well as what they say they want. You know, just as important when someone plays the violin is the look on their face, you know, their body language. So good makers are you know, very attentive to their clients. And you know, if one doesn't work, then you build another one. So I think we do that. We can't do it as straightforwardly as we'd like to. But my shop motto is there are no bad violins. There's only unfinished violins. And, you know, whether it means making a new top or a new back, I've made a new top, then a new back for an instrument. And I've done that more than once because wood is unpredictable and every piece is different. And even graphite fiber, different resins, different batches, they're maddeningly different. They may be subtle differences, but they're differences that, I mean, violinists are subtle people.
So given the time, I'm afraid we'll have to keep the questions for private. But before that, let's thank Joseph again.
Thank you very much. Thank you.